Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Experience summer comfort for less. Explore our sale on curtains and bedding. Perfect time to update and freshen your home.
I want to kick off today with the issue of tinnitus, because it's been a busy summer of gigs, events. Gigs are loud, big speaker stacks and the like. Do people know the impact it's had? Indoor events also, when people are in a confined room with all of the singing along, which is like the best efforts maybe of event organisers to try and keep sound within the appropriate and healthy limits. There is also screaming and singing along and everything else goes on in indoor gigs. Now, it's something that people might live with for many years. It can have an awful effect, not only on people's hearing, but also on their mental health as well. Frank Kennedy, good afternoon to you.
Hello, Colin. How's it going?
Making noise was your job, but I suppose it's wrong to describe it as noise, keeping the rhythm in a band.
That's right, Colin, yeah. So I'm a drummer, part-time drummer, I suppose. I kind of developed tinnitus probably about 17 years ago. I remember it was after a gig in town in Dublin City. I think it was a Tuesday evening we were playing, a blues set. And I remember I went home and I could, you know, my ears were sorer than they usually would be. And obviously was kind of very familiar with tinnitus, or just a sort of temporary tinnitus you'd get from going to a loud gig maybe. But this was me playing myself, and it felt different this time, and it didn't go away, unfortunately.
And still with you?
So, it is, yeah. So now I've, you know, it's not bad. I've learned to kind of to live with it, I suppose. I think initially, as you said there in your intro, you know, it wasn't that it affected my hearing so much. You know, I could hear everything as normal, but it was more the kind of the silence, you know. I sort of lost the privilege of silence, I suppose. You know, you could hear the whistle and the high pitched noise.
Could you just
in very quiet moments, you know?
For people who don't know what it is, I mean, if you were sitting in a silent room, what do you have to put up with?
I've learned to put up with it, but when you first get it, for me anyway, it's that you hear this constant kind of high-pitched whistle or high-pitched signal in your ears, you know, it just doesn't go away. You know, you're very conscious of it. If you're in a louder kind of situation, you may not notice it as much. It might depend on how badly you have it. But for me, it was kind of, you know, at night time going to bed or sitting in a quiet room, you'd really notice it. And as you said, you know, it was it took a bit of time to kind of come to terms with mentally, because, you know, it was preventable. I sort of felt that I had sort of, you know, given up something that a kind of a privilege of being able to have sort of silence when I wanted it. I gave it up couldn't ever get it back. And you don't ever get it back, you know.
And how would it have been preventable? I mean, you're, you know, a drummer in a band, you're trying to listen to the music, you're keeping the rhythm, you're reacting to maybe, you know, it's not a recorded piece, so you're reacting to the band around you. You're responsible for maybe keeping the time of the band, so you have to be totally on alert. Is it possible to kind of wear earplugs or ear defenders as a drummer?
Well, it is, yeah. Well, it is, but I suppose the thing with playing the drums is, certainly with an acoustic drum set, you know, generally you can't really turn the volume down in it, you know. I mean, obviously there's different kind of measures you can take about kind of muffling your drums and stuff like that, that will, you know, and using quieter sticks and things like that. But in general, you don't have a volume control button, right? It's an acoustic instrument, and sound waves are being generated when you hit those instruments, and you've no real control over the volume. So drummers are probably more impacted than others because they don't get to control the volume. But yeah, earplugs, as you said, are hearing protection. That's how you prevent it, right? And there's no shortage of options on the market today. You know, you get them in any music store or online. I was aware of them, obviously, I probably had planned at some stage to kind of get myself a set of earplugs, but you know, too little too late, unfortunately.
Right, and you had already experienced hearing loss, had you?
Funnily enough, I was actually, I'm actually deaf in one ear, and that's kind of from childbirth. So I was aware of that I had an extra responsibility about my ears, you know, because I only had one good ear. So that probably made it a little bit more, made the kind of, I don't know, the sense of guilt and maybe loss a little bit more profound in my case, because I knew I should have been protecting my ears better. But I would have been familiar with tinnitus just from, the kind of temporary tinnitus probably everybody gets, even people who don't play music. But when you go to a loud gig, especially in an indoor situation, or a loud outdoor gig, you know, you might get a day after, say, you're kind of, oh, my ears are ringing, you know, that kind of thing.
And then I can only think of, one gig in my teens that my friends went to. They came back afterwards and earplugs had been distributed. It was a gig in the SFX in about 1991 or 1992. The band that was playing My Bloody Valentine had a reputation for seriously high-pitched and, noisy music. So they gave out earplugs, optional earplugs to people. Now, not a lot of people didn't avail of them and came out, as you say, with that temporary tinnitus. They thought they'd, they'd maybe impair the experience by putting in the earplugs. Your advice is that it's better to put in the earplugs and defend your ears in your own long-term interests.
Well, certainly if you're playing the music, if you're kind of, I'm not an ear specialist, right? So I wouldn't be giving out any kind of medical advice around protecting your ears if you're just a kind of a casual concert goer or a gig goer. But I think generally, as long as you're not right on top of the speakers, you'll probably be okay. But something like My Bloody Valentine, absolutely, they're known for being super loud. It's part of their thing, right? But certainly if you're playing music, if ever I'm sort of playing music in a band situation, certainly with someone younger who maybe is kind of starting out or whatever, or someone's kids are getting into it, the first thing I'd always say is make sure you kind of invest in some good hearing protection, because it will come back to bite you.
And do they give out that advice in music shops?
I'm not sure. The products will be freely available there, I think it's a personal choice for a lot of, a lot of musicians would say it's a musician's curse, tinnitus, and some people don't like them because they think it impedes their ability to maybe hear the music properly. A lot of the hearing protection now, it's not just like putting cotton wool in your ears. It's, they're properly designed earplugs for musicians. I got a pair shortly after I got my tinnitus. I got specially molded to fit my ear. But you don't even have to do that. You can get them for 20 or 30 euro online, and they've a range of different filters you can put in them for different volumes you might be playing at. And they effectively cut out the dangerous frequencies while still allowing you to hear the music, So it's not like you can't hear what's going on around you. But some people, it's a personal preference. They just don't, they don't like them. But you will, anybody who watches anything on TV, any live performance on TV or goes to gigs, you'll see musicians with in-ear monitors and things like that. And they regularly have hearing protection built into them as well, So a lot of professionals would use them,
And how long had you been gigging before this happened to you?
Oh, God, maybe 10 years or something. Eight or 10 years, but...
And what was the kind of prevailing culture, amongst drummers and musicians when you, started gigging? Did anybody wear them? Was there a sort of a bravado thing where they were nearly frowned upon? Was it just not talked about, no awareness?
I don't think it was a bravado thing necessarily. There probably wasn't as much knowledge about it at the time, And then, obviously, lots of information available on the internet and stuff, and much more so nowadays. But, it was probably more a lack of information, really, than a bravado thing. And then, I guess musicians and drummers just learning to live with it over time, really, as I have, right?
A lot of the living with it seems to be, from what you're saying, is psychological. In the initial stages, it wasn't going away. So there must have been a while. You've been dealing with this now for 17 years. At the start, where you still lived in hope that this was just going to stop of its own accord?
I sort of knew by doing my own research that it probably wasn't going to go away. It's kind of fairly bleak when you realise that. But I think, I spoke to friends of mine who were drummers who had experienced something similar, and they were still playing music and were still they were positive, and it wasn't you know, the end of the world for them. They found a way to kind of get through it. Okay. And I suppose you're different. Everyone has different sort of ways to deal with it. But just, I guess you learn to train yourself to try not to hear that noise. Now, for me, I may not have it as bad as other people, right? I've been able to do that to kind of, I try, I don't focus on it, you know. If I did focus on it, it would probably annoy me, but I probably try and pick up on other ambient noises that might be around me, even in a quiet setting. There's usually some sort of a noise, and your brain probably just learns to focus on that. Okay. You know?
And is that all self-taught, or did you have to do cognitive behavioural therapy
that's just kind of, you know, I wouldn't even say self-taught. There's no other choice, you know. That was just a reaction, I suppose.
Of devastating consequences. I mean, 8 years ago, the drummer from the Manchester band, the Inspiral Carpets, sadly, I suppose, lost the battle in his own mental health struggles with dealing with tinnitus, and tragically ended his own life. And his wife made an appeal. That was Craig Gill. Yeah, his wife Rosemary made an appeal to people to seek help for tinnitus and to be aware of it. I mean, if anyone is affected by this, they can go to rte.ie/helplines. But, you know, it can be very debilitating for people.
Yeah, well, I'm sure. So I was probably fortunate enough that I maybe had a mild dose with now. The drummer you mentioned there was obviously, you know, playing a lot more shows than I would have been playing, and recording a lot more than I would have been recording. So, you know, and obviously probably a bit older than me as well. So maybe there was even less knowledgeable back then. So, certainly the longer you go without protecting your ears. So even if you have tinnitus, right, even if, you know, if it comes on, you should still wear hearing protection, you know, that would be my recommendation anyway. Right.
Even if you're not drumming, like if you're doing jobs around the house, using a drill or a lawnmower, that kind of stuff.
Well, actually, funny enough, in the kind of maybe the months and year after, whenever I was mowing the lawn or anything like that, yeah, I would definitely warn my earplugs. Now, I probably don't as much anymore, but that's probably just because they've settled down a little bit maybe over the years. But the certainly playing music, absolutely. I'd always, I'm a bit sort of, a bit OCD about double checking my pockets, that I have my earplugs in my pockets before I go out, you know, and I have a backup pair and things like that. I've learned my lesson, I suppose, you know.
And, okay, well, look,
yeah, like I said.
Thanks for bringing us to our attention. That's somebody who was... Thanks very much for that, Frank. Obviously, Frank, you know, his job exposed him to a lot of noise. Helen Dempsey, good afternoon to you.
Hi, how are you?
You've experienced this. We gave you a shout to tell us about it. Tell us how tinnitus has manifested itself for you.
Right, 10 years ago, I was... Well, it could have been from a car accident I had. So I developed this buzzing noise in my ears, and like the former caller there, I checked into it. So I said I'd go to a specialist, and I went to him. And fortunate, he was very good to me. He told me his own mother had tinnitus, but it can be very challenging now in the beginning. So he said, there is nothing we can do for tinnitus. Hearing aids, nothing. He said, tinnitus just comes. It doesn't generally go away when you have it a while. It might come and go if you got a cold or stuff, but definitely if it's there a while, it will stay for good. So he said, you have to learn to live with this. He said, my own mum has it. And he said that the only way you can get rid of tinnitus is become deaf.
Right.
So that wasn't... Obviously, I'm going to take that. So went along and he explained. He said this was the easiest way he could explain it to me. He said, you have a train going by your house every evening, every night, and you hear the train in the beginning. But as you work into it, you work ways that you don't hear the train anymore, or an airplane going over your house. So you come along and you just deal with it and you don't hear it. So he said, what he would tell me to do was, don't capitalise on it. If you capitalise on it, you're going to hear it more.
How do you mean? Do it as in concentrate on it? Is this?
Yeah, talking about it. Like, if I said, kept talking about it today, I will hear the Tinnitus tonight. And, you know, the more you talk about it, the more it kind of comes back to you. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, so are you reluctant? I mean, we're all the more appreciative for you to come on and raise awareness of it. So, I mean, were you reluctant to talk about it?
No, because I'll just learn to deal with it. You know what I mean? It's only talking about a few hours and getting back on it, the idea of not talking about it. The more you talk about it, the more it comes back.
Right.
And it's like something you put at the back of your mind. That's in other words. So how you deal with it is you don't think about it, you don't talk about it, you just deal with it. It's like a buzz of noise. In the beginning, it really affected me. It's like the wrong channel on the radio. If you have a lot of people in a room, say, for instance, 10 people, we'd say 5 or 6 people, and they're all talking at one time, I'd have to get up and go out.
Just
because I'm hearing a whole lot of different people talking at the one time.
And you just can't distinguish. It just becomes a jumble,
is
it?
What's going on? Yeah, it's mumble jumble. The other bad thing for me when I got it, my friends and my family used to say, why are you shouting? We're just beside you. And I'm saying, but there's a buzzing in my eyes, in my ears, so I have to talk over it. So I'm shouting a lot. So you develop where you're shouting, you know, because you're trying to talk over it. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I do. And what Frank described was like a high-pitched tone or a piercing
buzz.
Whistle. What you get a buzz,
so
is it?
Now.
Right.
Yeah, kind of a buzz. A kind of off channel, you know, that sort of buzzing mostly.
And what do you do? You say, I just put it out of my mind, or I put it to the back of my mind.
Right. When
just talk us through how you manage that.
Right. So say if I'm in the car, I'll put on music or upon live show or whatever's going on the radio. I can't hear it then. It's, you know, it's only when it's very quiet, I'll hear it. But then I'd put on something like, say, a song, a play to just have music at night time, but very, very light in my ears to go to sleep, because very quiet can affect you badly.
Right. So you need something kind of external so that will take your concentration long enough for you to fall asleep.
Or something like that. You know, you can get all them type of things, a playlist of the sea or of anything that will just not be very quiet. If it's very quiet, you can hear it.
Right. I've heard some of those playlists of the sea, and some of them, for reasons best known to the people who made them, include the sound of seagulls. Are you a seagull or non-seagull soundtrack of the sea
I'm
person?
I'm a water.
Just the water.
Right. So, yeah, or something like that, you know. But dead silence will affect you more, but it has a major effect on anyone when they first get it.
Back to socialising, Helen, because you mentioned there, if you're in a group of 5 or 6 people and it's a jumble and you have to get up and go out, have you found over time that you just avoid larger social gatherings, or have you in some way learned to deal with those social gatherings where you might alert the group of people you're talking to going, look, I have tinnitus. If I don't hear you, I might need you to repeat yourself, or do you kind of...
Oh, yeah, I make all my friends and family aware I have tinnitus. They know I have tinnitus. Mm. And I make them aware of it. But a whole lot of people talking at the one time can affect me, definitely.
So, like, say at a wedding, something like that, or those kind of social occasions, with a group of people sitting around a table, do you find you really just have to concentrate your conversation on the person who's exactly beside you?
Exactly. Hmm. I'll talk to who's beside me that type of thing. Yeah, but eventually... Believe it or not, you learn to put it at the back of your mind, like the other listener said. It's hard to explain to you live, but we can work on it to put it at the back of our mind. I know it's hard for you to understand, but it is something you can put to the back of your mind, that you're not bringing it. The minute you bring it up close to you, you're thinking about it.
Okay.
And then you're hearing it more.
Okay, Helen, thanks for that. Sean Dignan, good afternoon to you.
How are you?
Thanks for having me on. I'm good, thanks. So tell us about your experience of it.
So I got, following a throat infection 14 months ago, I was left with tinnitus, and I didn't really know what it was, a kind of like a buzzing type of a sound. 24/7, wouldn't go away. So I went off on a journey of ENTs, brain scans, blood tests, everything, and the audiologist as well. No hearing loss, no problem with any of those things that I just mentioned, and then kind of can't find any answers. So then I went on a journey of, you know, Imatsu, reflexology, aromatherapy, acupuncture, and on and on. And I'm still
any
on
joy?
That journey. No, you see, this is the thing, and I'm so glad that you mentioned it, because it, sometimes you feel quite bad about it when you say it. Well, I do, because, you know, people are going through things like, you know, cancer or, you know, serious illnesses. And I go, oh, God, I have tinnitus, and, you know, it's kind of there all the time, and it's kind of really kind of annoying. And then I feel kind of like, oh, God, really, you got buzzing in your head, like, you know, big deal. But just, if it gets in on you, like I've learned as time goes on, you know, I've learned to kind of know that it's there. I don't really notice it during the day or when I'm out walking, but at night time or in the office, you can really hear it. And I've got to put on a kind of like a masking sound, a tinnitus masking sound, to distract your brain from the noise.
And are there any particular sounds that work for you on that?
So I have a particular masking sound that I put on at night time. And actually, my wife actually beside me, she doesn't mind the sound. You put it on quite low. It's kind of like, almost like a crickets, that type of sound, like a crickety type of thing. Some people, as that lady said, you know, they do, you know, it's the sea or whatever. Mine seems to work on a kind of a crickety type of a thing. But the habituation thing seems to be a situation like somebody described, you know, the plane living beside the airport or the train, you know, etc. You put it to the back of your mind. But I'm so glad, I really mean it, I'm so glad you've raised it, because it is a massive, massive thing around the world. This kind of, you know, feeling a sound in your head that's not there. And it's not a disease. And when you can't get an answer for it, you can go down all sorts of rabbit holes, which I've been doing for 14 months. And
14 months, right.
14 months I have it now. And, you know, I'm sitting in my garden now and I'm going, you know, people have worse issues to deal with. But if it gets in on you, it can be tough. That's all I can say.
And there's nothing you could, the throat infection was the immediate trigger for you, but did you do kind of, did you work in any kind of a loud industrial atmosphere?
No.
Did you go to a lot of gigs? You know, did you go to kind of loud nightclubs? Is there anything that you think in the past this might have also been a contributory factor? Or do you think just the throat infection also just triggered a secondary ear infection and that went on to do the tinnitus?
Yeah, I think, and then somebody has said to me as well that, you know, this whole COVID thing has brought on a plethora of weird things that have happened to people, you know, loss of smell, you know, your hearing and all of those type of things. And I'm wondering, is it to do with that? Do I go to gigs? Absolutely love going to gigs. But am I exposed to loud music all the time? Like that drummer chap said, no.
Frank, yeah.
And I've had the hearing test and I don't have any issues. I've had my ears done. I've had the no wax. So I suppose the annoying thing I'd probably say is, when you want to find an answer for something, you know, if you break your leg or break your arm or you have a problem with your tooth, you go to the dentist. This is one of those things that no matter where you go, no matter what, people are very nice and people are very kind, but you can't seem to get an answer for this. Like, am I going to have this? I'm 60. Am I going to have this now, you know, until I pass away?
Right.
I really would not like to have that. But you know what? Those are the people are in Gaza getting bombed. I mean, look, I don't know. But to get an answer is the problem.
You can't play the sound to a doctor. You have to describe it and then...
Exactly.
I mean, do you ever have to put up with, you know, or have you ever encountered people doubting whether it's happening or whether it's just it is in your head, but whether it's kind of psychosomatic?
Mm. Well, they say it's not a disease. You know, it's a symptom of. And then, as I suppose, it's trying to find what the symptom is that's triggering it. People will say it can be stress, it can be, you know, it can be work, it can be, you know, you could be going through a divorce, you could be going through an illness, it could be all sorts of things. And if you could just find out at the end and somebody said to you, hey, listen, do you know what that is? It's your disc in your back is causing this nerve thing going on. And that's the problem. So we need to go and work on that and then that's going to solve that for you. And then you'd go, brilliant, a bit of rehabilitation, I can get there. But it's the fact that there is really no answer. And if you do go on, you know, the dreaded Google, oh my God, you'd be drinking, apple cider vinegar.
Which, as any doctor will say, you know, you could find yourself down the rabbit hole of all manner of monstrous illnesses and maybe even more deadly cures the further and more exotic areas of the internet you go into.
That's exactly it. And then you're doing exercise, clicking your fingers at the back of your head. You're taking, you know, ginkgo biloba herbs. You're taking, you know, melatonin at nighttime to help you sleep. I mean, it's on and on and on and on. But it never really changes. And I would say one thing. I would describe mine. I've been told that mine is like a grade 2 tinnitus, like a 4 out of 10.
Right.
And I went to an ENT in Beaumont Private. A guy called Adrian. Sorry, I know I can't mention names. Sorry.
Yeah, don't
went
say,
to the ENT guy, and he said to me, Sean, we have patients here with 10 out of 10 tinnitus, and they're suicidal with us. It's very, very serious. So I'm thankful that my tinnitus is a 4 out of 10, because some people, how they live with this sound at a level 10 must be absolutely horrendous. Right. It must be just desperate.
Well, thanks very much for that. Obviously, you're not advocating ginkgo biloba, nor are we. We're going to take a break. We're back in a minute.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
Now, anyone listening to the news during the week might have heard that the UK, in time for its next general election in 2029, is going to extend the vote to 16-year-olds. It's been under discussion in Ireland for a while. A citizens' assembly looked at this issue back in 2013 and recommended, and they initially looked at the question of dropping the voting age to 17, but most of the people, a narrow majority on the citizens' assembly, thought we'd drop it to 16. A cross-party motion in the Dáil, signed off on by, as I say, a cross-party motion does exactly what it says on the tin, progressed in the Dáil completely unopposed. So is that where we're headed? Could votes for under-16s be introduced only with the aid of a referendum to change the constitution and the voting age? So what do people think of it? Kevin Byrne, good afternoon to you.
Hello, Colm. How are you keeping?
How are you doing?
Not too bad, sir. I was watching the news, the BBC news last night, and I was a bit exercised by this. I'm turning into a grey old man, so to speak. And I was thinking on reflecting on ages and how it affects us, because 50 and more years ago, I got my driving license at 17, so I could do that at 17, but I couldn't drive a big truck or fly an aeroplane because I needed to be older. You know, we have age limits in place for a good reason. But reflecting on the Supreme Court decisions in the Republic, we have a situation where people who haven't reached majority, as they call it, or their 18th birthday, cannot be identified in public, even though the crimes they're committed or they have committed and are convicted of are serious. Like murder, for example, there was a few cases last year, I think, and the case was brought forward that when these people reached 18, can we identify them? And the answer is no, even if they're over 18. So we have a situation here where somebody says you're a child until your 18th birthday for purposes of law and convictions and that kind of thing, and other events like driving or flying, whatever it might be. But if you want to give them the vote, they're mature enough at 16, 17, up to 18 to have the vote. So it doesn't cut ice with me in that regard.
On the other hand, at 16 years of age, you can work a 40-hour week. You can pay the associated taxes with that. You can have a dog license. You can assent to medical treatment. So, you know, why not vote?
Well, we have a dichotomy, though, you know, but why should we then not see your case if you're brought to court for any particular purpose until you're 18? Why does the law, going back many hundreds of years, say that you're still a child in some ways? You can't be a child one day and then an adult or a mature person in other aspects the next day. So it's a heck of a dichotomy and a decision that has to be made. And it's a legal one from that point of view, Colm, I think.
But if you can already vote, or sorry, if you can already, you know, drive below the age of 18 and you can assent to medical treatment, that dichotomy is already there and the law can cope with that.
It is. It's just a funny one, isn't it? I mean, I think we should bring the actual Supreme Court decisions down, though we can't. Maybe we should have a referendum on that, saying people who are 16, you know, have reached the age of maturity and therefore they're, you know, legally entitled to be seen in court and identified as such. But it's a case that goes back and it's just a strange one. I mean, you can get, a firearm certificate at 16, if I'm correct, and that kind of thing. So there are rules in some ways which are age-related and some which are not.
Maybe it would be unfair to identify people at the age of 16 who are associated with court cases until you gave 16-year-olds the vote. So if you extended the franchise to 16-year-olds, you could have a referendum or a vote on that in order to canvass the views of 16-year-olds.
And I've no great, what's the word, you know, no problem with that in any way. But as it was pitched on the UK news last night, it was a tiny bit cynical in that it is expected that the people who are, you know, 16 to 18 might actually vote in a certain way that is socialist as opposed to, you know, conservative. So there was a lot of cynicism on some of the commentators made last night. I hope that wouldn't happen in our debate here in the Republic. Okay. I can't imagine it would.
All right. You're a Guinness. Owen Gilroy, where do you stand on it?
Hi, good afternoon. Yeah, I think it's sort of a question about equality. You know, many of the same issues that you were talking about there, you know, so you have the ability to go out and work a 40-hour week. You have the ability to get married. You have the ability to leave school. You know, all of these issues and stuff, you know, why can you do that at 16, but you can't vote and have it to say on, you know, how much taxes you're paying? And all of that good stuff. But I think some of the arguments as well that I'm hearing from the other caller there,
Kevin,
I think they're weak, to be honest, because, you know, I studied law and politics, and I think, you know, there's an issue of protecting someone's identity, particularly when they're at such a young age, as 16 and 17, that something like, you know, having, you know, their name released in court documents, that could have a real impact on their ability to secure a job down the line. And obviously there'll be, you know, convictions and stuff there, you know, and that's due to, you know, the establishing Garda vetting and all of that. But I think that, you know, it is a weak argument because, you know, for the likes of, let's say, a vulnerable adult or an adult who is in, you know, care, that could also have, there can also be applications to block their identity from being released in court documents and all of that. So it is a dichotomy, absolutely, but I think more so it's a matter of sort of fairness and equality.
Yeah, so sell us the benefits as you see them, and when did you develop the view that they should be extended?
Of course. So I worked on a research project back in 2016 and 2017 with Senator Lynn Moran and Senator Fintan Warfield. And I worked with about 1,200 students from secondary schools all across Dublin on developing, you know, a sort of the basis for the bill that went to the Seanad then. And it was very clear to us that, you know, students do have the knowledge of issues that are going on. I mean, the marriage equality referendum had just passed. I mean, a lot of social issues that students and particularly young people care about. So they're passionate about it. They want to get involved and want to participate and have their say. And I think for me personally, it is a matter of fairness about, let's say, oh, they should be able to vote because they can work, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay.
But it's also, I think we as a society should also be focusing on the benefits of it in that, you know, getting people involved in the early age, you know, whether it's just the local and European elections, which can be done through a simple act of bureaucracy, that will enable and facilitate political involvement and political engagement throughout their life and bolster our turnout here, because across Europe, Ireland has particularly a low turnout rate.
Okay.
In local and Europeans and general elections.
Okay, Aileen, what do you make of that? Aileen Eglinton.
I was listening to that and I don't agree at all. I'm in Italy at the moment and the voting age here in Italy is 18. It's 18 in so many of the European countries. And I think that, like, at 16, most people are only just finishing their junior cert. And I think it's much more important, myself, that we start to educate kids in school about the importance of participation right across the community. So that when they get to 18, we then start to talk to them about how important it is to use your vote. I just think at 16, people are too young. And it also affects the whole legal issue, because you become an adult in the law, in the courts, etc. at 18. And that's what I think. I think it changes everything.
Right. But I suppose, you know, people might also argue that, you know, you've done your near mandatory CSPE up until junior cert. You're freshly engaged with all your newfound knowledge. And at age 16, you know, in the transition year, you can be engaged in political activist projects. You can get your vote, you can get on the voting register while you're there. Whereas if it drifts too long at the age of 18 and it's up to yourself, maybe you won't become engaged.
Well, maybe it depends on the type of household you live in and how your parents can empower you. I was always brought up to always use my vote. And that was from age 18 onwards. So there you go. I mean, I'm thinking back on this. I was 16 when I did my Leaving Cert. And I was one of those people who went straight into the workforce and did all my third level by night. So maybe.
So you would have been well able to vote.
I'm well able to talk and vote. But I think things are different now because, you know, a lot of people aren't leaving even secondary education until they're 18 or 19, and then they're going through college. Maybe I was different then, and I think a lot of people of a certain age, all went into the workforce much earlier.
Okay,
and
well,
we were part of the workforce.
I'll go back to Owen on that. Owen, Aileen's the exception here.
I think it's funny, you know, that argument as well, that, I mean, you know, I know many 18-year-olds who I think, you know, who haven't a clue about politics and, you know, just vote for the sake of voting or vote based on, you know, what their parents voted and stuff too. But I'm not saying, and maybe they shouldn't be able to have a vote, but I'm not saying that this should be done in isolation. This should be done in combination with enhanced political education. It's great to see politics and society becoming a Leaving Cert module. That should become a module throughout the 6 years in secondary school, giving people an opportunity to participate, learn about social issues, learn about the economy and how things are done. This is not something that should just be done overnight. It's something that needs to be done in combination with enhanced political education in secondary school and even primary school for students. Because like you're saying, and, you know, saying there that 16, 17-year-olds, they may not know what's going on and stuff too. But the onus is on us to inform them on our education system, to give them the tools to be able to understand, oh, what is a complex issue? You know, we're seeing many students who are, you know, particularly in climate change, who are very passionate about that. Do we think that our government leaders and our local and European politicians are, you know, helping with that, are supporting with that? No, because it is not an issue that is on, you know, it's lost its priority on the agenda in Ireland.
Aileen,
young people can get that back up.
Aileen, you come from a politically engaged household by your own admission. You were encouraged by your parents, you know, to use your vote when you got it. There are, you know, children who come from non-politically engaged households, and traditionally poorer areas have lower levels of political participation. So for students who might need something external to the home to get them politically involved, is their time in school not maybe an opportunity to get them involved in voting at that point to establish the habit of a lifetime so that if they're rearing a family, they'll encourage their children to be politically involved? What would you say to that?
I don't agree with that in general. And the reason why is I think we should be trying to, I think we should be trying and really, really trying to get all our younger people engaged in everything to do with volunteerism and the community and getting involved within all the communities. And I totally agree from that sense that maybe coming from different backgrounds and maybe poorer backgrounds or whatever word you want to use to describe it. I think it's a learning curve. And I just don't believe that bringing the voting age to 16 is the solution to this.
Okay.
I think that from a legal perspective, I think we should be leaving the age 18 at that age. We should also be doing so much more work in our schools to help people to engage at all levels.
Okay, well,
when they come to 18, they're prepared.
I think both yourself and Owen at least agree on the point that more should be done in schools to get people politically engaged. Julie, good afternoon to you.
Hello there, Colin. How are you?
What hope do you hold out for young people politically engaging?
Well, I agree with both those speakers. I think really has to start with education at 18. And there is a transition year time now where, as you say, a module can be done in the school to stimulate interest, if nothing else, you know, and to, you know, impress on young people how hard won the vote was all those years ago and how people even lost their lives to get the right to vote. And I suppose I'm a bit like Aileen. I grew up in, I won't say an active political family, but with an interest in politics. And, you know, you'd be talking about your local candidates and people from your area that would be going for politics. You know, you'd be chatting around the table about it. But the reason I rang into your researcher there was coming up in the local local elections there last year, I was meeting with a group of youngsters, young people, I won't say youngsters, maybe 22, 23 plus. And, you know, the local elections were in full swing, posters everywhere, like all these people on social media, flyers, people, canvassers calling to the doors and everything. So I breezed in and I said, well, lads, are we all set to vote? it was maybe within a week of voting, and they looked blank, totally blank. Now, these would be 23-year-olds entering the workforce, maybe some of them in the workforce, and they smiled and they said, So they said, smiled nicely and said, not sure really what it is, you know. And I said, well, you know, it's the local elections, and like we have your neighbours or, you know, even relations could be up for elections and all the posters. No idea, no kind of, no knowledge or no awareness of the importance of, you know, even starting at local elections.
Right. Never mind. Well, I mean, if an engaged 16-year-old was interested in voting, you know, that's a 23-year-old or somebody in their early 20s by choice being disengaged. Maybe if they had got the opportunity to vote at the age of 16, come the age of 23, you know, they'd have seen a whole life cycle of a government already and be making a decision on the basis of the record of the last people they voted for.
Oh, I don't know, Colm. I think 16-year-olds, they have other kind of things on their minds at 16. I still think, I know they don't think they're children, because even I have a daughter here, and when she became 17, not 16, she was looking up all the things she could legally do at 17. So I suppose maybe a little bit older than 16. I think 16 is very young, but education definitely has a place to become aware, or even, you know, in their locality, how come these 22, 23 plus year olds, you know, maybe it was through choice, but it's a sad situation, I suppose, Colm, that they don't seem to have any, even when I said, oh, surely you'll vote, and I even asked, are you registered to vote? And they said, why do you have to register to vote? You know, I said, God. So just a bit, you know, dismayed and kind of, and I have my daughter here now, she's coming 18 in August, and she's actually looking forward to voting. And she said, oh, I'll be able to vote now in the presidential election. So that was nice to hear, you know, but because I suppose we're kind of, I wouldn't say politically active, but we have an interest in politics, I suppose, and in the welfare of our country.
There was a time, though, where people made the argument, you know, that women weren't rational enough to serve on juries, that giving women the vote would be an act of madness. And, you know, that was disproven. In fact, now people, you know, want more women to be elected. They want more women in leadership positions. And, you know, the world didn't fall off the edge of the cliff as the naysayers and the doomsayers predicted.
So, well, we're talking 100 years ago.
Yes, and lots of women, you know, the suffragettes, I mean, you could go back there and educate children on the importance and the work that women did back then. You know, there's a lot of, I think, education needed, as those previous speakers said, Colm, just, and I definitely think there's an opportunity in schools, particularly your transition year and modules there, just even to make them aware of it and the importance of it. I really do think.
But you're not up for giving it to them at 16 at this stage?
No, I don't think so, Colm. Even that responsibility, I don't think so. No.
Okay. Johnny, what's your view?
Colm, just a very brief point. They can't vote at the moment until they're 18. If that was lifted and moved to 16, for what reason, I'd ask that the politicians would push that. But yet you cannot become a politician till the age of 21. So why is it good enough to vote and not good enough to join them?
Okay, well, I suppose people might argue that, you know, the legislation of the land has an impact on 16-year-olds. If they can, you know, work a 40-hour week and pay the taxes and all of those things, they can hold a dog licence, assent to medical treatment, all of those kind of things. Political decisions are being made that affects their life, so let them vote.
Yeah, and I wouldn't be totally against letting them vote, but I'd say if you'd done a survey of 16-year-olds and asked them who was in government at the moment, probably 80% of them wouldn't be able to tell you. Because it's not that they're not able to vote. I don't think they have an interest at that age of what's going on in the country, really, in relation to politics and that.
Like, but you could say the same about anyone under the age of 25, though. I mean, the level of engagement is lower there, too.
It is, so maybe to get them into it early, I don't know, or maybe let them vote in a presidential election where it doesn't have such a bearing outcome on you know, what government decisions are. It's more of an honorary role, really.
Right. You sound like you'd be nervous about the type of decisions a 16-year-old might take.
I probably would. I've one nearly 16, and like they think they're adults, but they're not. And I just wonder why the government would be endorsing this or pushing it, for what reason?
Okay.
You know, and that, and then they cannot enter politics really until they're 21.
Okay, Michael McLaughlin, good afternoon to you.
How you doing?
You work for Youth Work Ireland. Youth participation and young people having, I suppose, a say in and a participation in the decisions that affect them is kind of the meat and drink of your daily work.
Yeah, and this is something, you know, we have favoured for a long time. I hear the comments and I do, you know, have to respond to them. One important thing to say in Ireland is this couldn't be done without a constitutional referendum. And in some respects, I think it could be difficult to have that referendum or pass it. So what a lot of people are advocating is to pilot it. We can do that. We can try it out at local and European elections. The Dáil can do that themselves. They don't need a referendum. So then you'd have a chance to see, well, how did it go? How it was, what was the level of education? Although I think there's a lot of improvement in civic and political education in school. And, you know, a lot of people have, as you said, I think, differential knowledge and interest in politics. So there is a way there, and that's what people have been talking about. And given that the UK are doing it now, I think it puts more pressure on us, quite frankly. A lot of European countries have done it. We'd have it in Northern Ireland, which, you know, could create a lot of issues with young people on the border. Some are voting in elections at that age and some aren't. And it's not a huge population, and they do have different views. Not all young people are going to vote the one way. There might be slight tendency to go for some parties rather than others. But when you add on into the whole mix of the millions of people voting, I think it's not quite as an alarming step as some people feel.
Okay. So, I mean, at the moment, the age of majority for most things is 18. Ireland has signed up to, you know, conventions on child soldiers and the like. So the age of, you know, joining the army has changed and everything else. And, you know, one of the arguments that's been made is let childhood be childhood. People, you know, become adults at the age of 18. Childhood is short enough. The Irish Association of Care Workers submitted to the Citizens' Assembly that reducing the voting age could increase what they call the adultification of children. How do you respond to that?
Well, we have kind of different ages for a lot of different things, actually, and it tends to aggregate around 18, but not exclusively. You know, we have driving license and tattoos, and actually we have a whole plethora of different ages for different things. So I certainly think that, you know, there's a big issue about putting things on the agenda. I think when older generations, there was big protests of pensioners, I think it was 10, 15 years ago, and the government kind of more or less caved in straight away. If young people come out and look for something on issues that say the minimum wage, where they get a lower minimum wage, no one pays any attention. And that's a bit of a problem then, because people get disillusioned and disenfranchised. And then when they hit 18, 19, they're saying, well, these people have never done anything for me in the past, you know. So, you know, we have to get the issues on the table. And I suppose I would also say sometimes Irish politics isn't always issues based. A lot of people do vote on other factors, who's the local person, who's looking after the local issues and all that kind of thing. I think young people are well able to understand those things.
All right, stay with us, Michael. Garrod Duffy, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, yes.
You think things should be going in the other direction?
Yeah, I think that we should look at the political life cycle, and that a person becomes interested in politics maybe when they're 15 or 16 or something like that. And the term of a Dáil is usually 4 or 5 years. So it's be important that people know the whole thing from the start to finish. Hear the propaganda, what people promised, then see the broken promises, and, you know, to get a full life cycle. Because we live in a representative democracy, and then it's a case about voting for who you think is best, or, you know, what one's values are, and what who's competent and who's trustworthy and has integrity. It's not just a plebiscite of the blind or a lucky dip going into the ballot paper, you know. I think just trivialises and diminishes democracy, you know, if we leave, like, the demos out of democracy. Democracy, you know, it's about the demos, that's the people. And it means the people, you know, discussing, the dialoguing, you know, debating matters. And out of that becomes a decision, not just walk in and willy-nilly and, you know, tick a box here or there, you know.
Right. So what age would you put the vote at?
I think 21 was always traditionally regarded as the age of responsibility, when people began to take a look to the future, where they're going to marry or whatever it is, where they have a stake in society, as they're looking forward to not just their own career, their own personal thing. You know, we come into the world, you know, we're dependent on others. We get a bit more independence than a codependence, and we begin to contribute back to society. And I think in that view of the future, that, you know, being part of the solution of problems, that's where we need to, you know, focus our attitude, you know, for about voting.
All right. Well, what would you say to the argument, if you're talking about raising it to 21, at the age of 18, you're old enough to die for your country, you should be given the entitlement to choose who's asking you to die for your country?
But again, what basis they make these decisions on? I mean, you have to, we're watching the political scenario, landscape for a few years before you see what happens. Like, for example, Barack Obama, when he was going for election, he spoke about getting rid of Guantanamo Bay. That never happened. We have to have the importance of somebody. You see the whole life cycle. You see what's promised and what happens.
Okay, but if the government is elected when you're 19, you're not going to see out that life cycle until you're 24. You've already had 3 years of being entitled to vote without being able to have to pass a verdict on the government.
I think most people become interested in parties when they're about 14, 15, 16 or something like that. And if they see a full cycle of the Dáil, it's, you know, adds 5 years to that. And you're, by 21, they should have seen, you know, if they're interested at all, what's involved in the whole political system, you know.
Okay.
I mean, like when I was young, I saw Henry Kissinger, you know, with Nixon and all them. You know, they were bringing peace to Vietnam, peace to Russia, peace to the Middle East. And we were swallowing it that, you know, peace is breaking out all over the world. But, like, roll on a few more years and you see that that's not the case. And I think it's the case with, you know, discussion programs or whatever else, people make promises. You know, sometimes the one with the loudest, loudhailer dominates. Some vices don't get looking. You begin to realise these things after a few years, you know. If the presidential elections, when you saw that tens of thousands were, you know, compensation were given to David Norris and John Gallagher and Diana Rosemary Scanlon, you know, because of what happened in the campaign with how the media presented them. And I think you become more wise to things if you have a whole, you know, a few years of seeing what's happening and how things go, you know, before okay. you actually cast the vote.
All right, Tom Cahill, what's your view?
How are you, Colm? I suppose I'm an intern as a politics and society teacher. I thought it would be interesting just to give my perspective, I suppose, working with...
Sorry, Tom, to cut across you. There's just a bit of breakup on your line there. You're a teacher of what?
I'm a teacher of politics and society. And I thought it would be interesting, I suppose, just to give my two cents on it from talking and dealing with students all of the time. I think there's a huge demand from young people to be engaged with politics and to be involved with it. And I suppose we introduced politics in our school just 2 years ago. And since then, we've had full classes and a huge demand for it. And I know that's the same. I talked with my politics and society teacher colleagues across the country. There is huge demand for young people to have their voices heard and to be involved in the decision making. And I think, you know, personally, I'm in favour of reducing the voting age to 16. And that really comes from engaging with students and young people on a daily basis and hearing what they have to say and taking their views on it. And they're very strong on the fact that they feel that, well, if they're able to go out and work and they're able to pay taxes, then they should be entitled to have a say in how those taxes are spent. And that's the main argument that they give back to me when we'd be discussing these things. And I think that really is what forms my view then on why we should be in favour of reducing the voting age to 16. Like, I take all of the other points about being an adult and all of those things, but I don't know why... I could never really understand why, you know, the definition of an adult had to be the same across the board. You know, like, people's priorities change as they get older, people vote in different ways. And so someone at the age 16 will have different priorities, and so they'll vote in a different way. But their voice is equally as important as somebody, you know, someone my age who has a vote, and my priorities will be different. But that's part of democracy.
Okay, and you teach at both that junior and the new senior cycle course as well, do you?
Yeah, so I started out as a geography and CSP teacher, and then when politics was introduced, I upskilled in that and have introduced it now in our school since then. I suppose I can only talk of my experience, where there has been huge appetite from many of the students I've ever taught for not just politics, but citizenship, I suppose, more generally. And then that follows through to the senior cycle. And I just find across the board, there's a much bigger uptake for young people in terms of the Corlin and Oak, student councils, green schools in particular. You know, climate change is one of their major issues. But I find sometimes we kind of box them into the climate change thing of like, well, it's, you know, young people are all interested in climate change. They're interested in so many more things. You know, there was a discussion there a few weeks ago on Liveline about tractor licences and having to do a test. And I was just thinking of the young people that I know that age, that for them, their issue would be having to do a test for driving their tractor
right.
at 16 or 17.
And quickly, Tom, so, just because we have another caller who wants to come in on this as well. In teaching people over the course of their school career, and without getting into, you know, party political preference specifically, but do you see people's views evolve the more they learn through CSPE?
Of course, it's like anything. It's the same with my views. Like, I didn't have the opportunity to
to study politics when I was in Leaving Cert, but my views have changed over the years as well. And it's the same for any person. Your views can change and adapt over time. And especially with a lot of young people, because they sometimes they'll see stuff online and they'll believe it straight away. But as they get more education on stuff, they tend then to, I suppose, get more informed views. But then I think that's part of our job, as my job as a teacher and more widely as society and indeed our politicians, to actually be informing people and giving them all the of the information. And because I know some of the arguments that get made are, young people see all these things online that aren't true, and that informs their decisions. And I don't go with that, to be honest.
Yeah, and the same could be said of the adult population, and they're out there with with nobody bringing them into a class and maybe debriefing them and prompting discussions. So maybe there's an element of adult political education could be facilitated as well for another day. And obviously, Tom, not in the classroom environment. We're going to take a break. Back in a minute.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, 0818 715 815.
Okay, big sporting weekend. First time Cork and Tip meet in an All-Ireland Senior Hurling Final. John Arnold, good afternoon to you.
Hi, Colm, how are you?
Are you going to the match?
Please, God, hopefully, and I hope to go to be, if I get that, it'll be my, I think it'll be my 105th All-Ireland Final, I hope, and
All right, yeah, just to fill people in, you haven't been going to hurling for 105 years. You're talking about the mix of codes there.
Yeah. No, I started going in 1972, the hurling final, and the football the following year. I've been to most of them since I missed an odd one because of a family bereavement or holiday, I think, but I've been to most of them, yes. I'm really looking forward to this. It'll be a really unique occasion, all right, you know?
Right. You might quibble with the idea historically that this is the first big showdown between Cork and Tip at this level, would you?
Yeah, I would really. Yeah, people are saying it's the first big match, you know. First time that they kind of played a big first inter-county match was actually in the autumn of 1741. Here, the reason I've an interest in it to see it played in my own parish, in a place called Kildoyne, and in the parish of Rocarmack, a townland of Linegowl. 1740, as you remember, well, sorry, you wouldn't remember, but 1740, there was a very bad famine that year in the country, a severe frost during 1740, rain right up till the summer, till the autumn. There was no harvest in 1740, and hundreds of thousands of people died. It was a shocking year. It was called Bleanan Oar, the year of the slaughter, and bad enough in the spring of 1941, but by the autumn of 1941, things were improved and there was a bit of a harvest and some crops were harvested, potatoes and things that way. And it seems likely that what happened, from all accounts anyway, is that in that autumn of 1741, around the country, different kind of bits of festivals and carnivals and celebrations were held to mark that the worst was over. And here in Rathcarmac, a hurling team, kind of sponsored, or I suppose patroned by the local landlord, Fitz Redmond Barry, he issued a challenge to a hurling team from anywhere, any takers, and a team led by a man called Dennis McGrath from the Tipperary side came down and they played Tipperary here in a field, not in a farmer's field, just about 25 a side. And we were confident that, well, we were fairly sure that Cork won it, but the Tipperary fellas brought a poet with them. They brought a poet with him, and when he went home, didn't he write a big long poem in Irish, of course, saying that Tipperary had won the match and how good they were and how bad Cork were. But if he did, a local Cork poet, Sean O'Murcoo, who's from Carrignavar here near us, he wrote a kind of he said that was the Cork fellas said it was fake news, and Sean O'Murcoo wrote a 10-verse poem in reply claiming Cork had victory. And both of those poems still exist, Gaelic poems in manuscripts in Maynooth, and it was only for that history that could be lost. Well, not that was pointed out.
It's a good thing it's a good thing we have Hawkeye rather than poets making the difficult decisions nowadays.
Yeah, and you can imagine with 25 aside that time, it played in an ordinary field. Who would have won or who wouldn't have won could be up for debate. But yeah, it's a great rivalry. I went to my first Cork Tip match in 1972 above in Limerick. It was a drawn match. I remember Roger Ryan got a couple of goals for Tipperary the same day. We beat him in the replay. But over the years, it's been a ding-dong. I mean, we saw local neighbours and rivals. And it's a great rivalry. There was a time, I don't remember, in the 1960s, when before I started going, when Tip really had the upper hand and they beat us in a series of matches. But since that, it's kind of gone, once a generation after generation. McCock have been on top for a while, and then Tip would get a few victories.
Right.
And that's where we haven't met in the final now, actually 20 years, you know.
So what's your own match day routine? Because we need to hear from somebody from Tip. But what's your own match day routine? Anything you do in particular every time you go to an All-Ireland by way of a ritual or superstition?
Yeah, well, the normal ritual is we would normally, and we probably do the same on Sunday. We don't tend to go up on Saturday night that much now, but normally try and milk the cows about 5 or 6 o'clock in the morning. We'd have sandwiches made since the night before. I know people have said, Jesus, is he still making sandwiches? And I suppose it didn't out of me in the Santee. There's plenty of restaurants and everything along the way, but I suppose it's kind of a tradition. I once eaten the sandwiches out of the boot of the car, but we'd still do that on Saturday evening and head off. We'd be planning to head off on Sunday morning about half past six or 7 o'clock in the morning. Now, whether we'll go the old main road up through Tipperary, the heart of the enemy country, I'm not sure yet. We might go over to the east of Ireland, because obviously you'll have 65,000 people on that road next Sunday.
Right.
And the tradition, before we pass the church here, stop and bless myself, say a prayer, and where our own hurling club was founded here alongside me, stop there for a second and think of all the great men that went in the past and head off then.
Okay.
We have the Haymaid already, so you know the song
long very good very good John. Don't be giving your match day route away now, because there'll be people looking to avoid all the toll barriers, as I'm sure you've heard. Sharon Fitzgerald, Tipperary, so what's the routine?
Hi.
For the match day, how are you doing? Thanks for talking to us.
No problem at all. Yeah, I'm really excited for Sunday. Like himself there now, I will be blessing myself every church we pass, and there'll be a few prayers said on the way up on the bus. So I'll be praying for a ticket first and then praying for the win.
All right. No ticket as yet.
No.
What about the lucky charm?
Oh, I have my lucky charm that's coming with me, and that was from the 2019 All-Ireland. Before we went into the stadium that day, we went into the Croke Park Museum, and they had a little mini Liam McCarthy trophy. So I bought it and I brought it into the final with me. And obviously that year, Tip won and Seamus Callanan lifted the Liam McCarthy. And after the match, we made our way around. And I, like, Seamus was signing jerseys and hurleys for the kids. And I made my way down and I handed him the little mini Liam McCarthy. And he signed that for me. So
right.
That's my little good luck charm. And that's coming with me on Sunday.
Very good. It's a relic nearly more than a charm at this stage, is it? Given that it's been touched by the hand. Right.
Yeah, that's
all right.
Exactly it.
Best of luck with the hunt for tickets, Sharon. We'll take a break. Back in a minute.
Thanks.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
Right, so far we've had blessings at the founding place of the club, people blessing themselves, passing every church on the way up, the lucky box of sandwiches. We've heard from Cork and Tip. Back to Cork. Eamon McCarthy, how are you?
I'm not too bad as I know. Call me yourself.
Good, thanks. Yeah, you're off to the match. So what ritual will you be following?
The last number of years we've gone up on the Sunday, but we're going to go back to old habits and go up on the Saturday night. We used to go up on Saturday all the time back in the day when we were winning All-Ireland. So hopefully we'll resume to the same sequence again.
Right. What will you be packing in the bag for the Sunday then?
Oh, what we'll have in the bag is... we'll have the jersey. It's jersey number 10 jersey I got from Shane Kingston many years ago. And after that, then there'll be the same pair of jocks, same pair of shoes, same aftershave, everything that we put on. Wear the same gear as every match.
Right. What are the shoes?
A pair of brown shoes. Brown leather shoes. And so long as we're comfortable. And listening to the other callers there, I have to tell you the truth now. I have to beat and have my chest out just with the excitement and the nervousness.
And how are you? What kind of aftershave?
Oh, Lacoste,
right. You could be a brand ambassador before the programme is over. There'll be people beating down the doors. The Shane Kingston jersey, how long have you had it?
I have it now in Nigeria's.
Right. And there's a baseball cap as well, is there?
From getting sunburned, you know. Hopefully we'll have sun on Sunday. I'm not too sure about this. And give you any sunburn, which will wear it anyway.
Okay, and just seeing as you mentioned sunburn there, it'd be wrong to leave listeners with the impression that you're only going in your jocks. You're wearing the lucky jocks, but a pair of trousers over them, obviously.
Oh, sure, we nearly have to, but I suppose we win, we could take them off sick. We're one more about that.
All right, best of luck, Eamon, with all of the travel and the bag packing and everything else. May the best team win. We're back in a minute.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, 0818 715 815.
Dan Quirk, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Colin.
Thanks very much for joining us. It's an emotional weekend for you. You'll be thinking of your late son, Dylan. Tell us about him.
Yeah, look, so Dylan was 24 when he died on the 5th of August 2022 in Semple Stadium, playing for his club, Clonoulty Rossmore, against Kilwan McDonagh's. He passed away with sudden adult death syndrome. We did everything we could under the stadium and in Southbury Hospital in Clonmel, but unfortunately we couldn't bring him back. And obviously it was a huge shock to us all, not just ourselves, the family, but the parish, I suppose, and maybe in Tipperary and outside of. A couple of months later, we decided to start the foundation. It's called the Dylan Quirk Foundation. And I suppose we didn't really know where it was going. We just wanted to get awareness out of SADS because we're losing two lives a week, young lives a week with SADS in Ireland, which is a huge number. And we just said we'd see where we go. And thankfully, it's going from strength to strength, and we're delighted where it is going at the minute.
And how soon after Dylan's death did you have the foundation up and running?
About 8 weeks later, we started it. And as I said, we didn't know where we're going. It probably started as a GA foundation, but really, since then, I think it's 13 sporting bodies involved in the foundation now, and they're being screened. So it's been a huge success story, and I guess the story went all over the country about Dylan. And it's going massive legs, and we're so delighted with the support we've got as a family and as a foundation, and it's been so successful.
It's some legacy for Dylan to have. I think, is it 10,000 tests in the 2.5 years you've been up and running?
It's actually, we need 10,000 in our first year, and we hope to do another 10,000 this year, which means we'll have 20,000 done. So it's a beautiful legacy for him, and I'm sure he's up there looking down on us, helping us along the way, and I'm hopeful he'll be helping Tipperary on Sunday to do the same. But it's been a massive success, and it's great for me. I've had phone calls from different parents thanking us for setting up the foundation and just telling us that we've saved lives. So yeah, it's great for us as a family, and it's great as a legacy for Dylan. What better could we do than only helping other parents not to go through what Hazel and myself are going through.
And but for his tragic death, he may have been on the pitch this Sunday.
Absolutely, there's every chance that he wore the number 5. He got Hurler of the Year there in Tipperary in 2022, the year he passed Tipperary Sports Club Hurler of the Year. He had a great year, even though Tipperary had no success that year. He was going from strength to strength, playing at number 5, and great to see his good friend Craig Morgan is wearing the number 5 on Sunday, his great pal. And I'm glad to say that a lot of Tip guys are coming over to us this evening to meet us for an hour, so they're great guys, and I hope that things go well for him on Sunday. And even if they don't go well, they've been great to us as a family, and it's brilliant to see them young guys enjoy themselves in Croke Park. We'd all love to be there. And we all love our young kids playing sport, but realistically, we feel as a foundation that safety in sport is the most important thing. So that's why we think screening is so, so important. They started screening initially over 20 years ago, and they've brought the death rate down by 89%. So it can make a difference. I just want to tell people how important screening is to young kids that play sport.
And that's the level you'd like to see it at, that, you know, at the Italian level, where it's just there, it's embedded in the sport, where people get at least an annual screening to try and reduce the rates of sudden adult death syndrome by the rates they've reduced it in Italy, nearly halved it.
That's right, absolutely. And I said, look, it will be difficult to get it mandatory, but more and more sporting bodies are coming on board with us, and there's more and more screening going on, and we're hearing an awful lot of good stories, and that's so important. Like, obviously, there's big money spent in all sporting bodies where players are buying helmets, buying boots, buying everything. We think safety should be number one, and that means being screened, and we will pick up 90% of heart defects through screening. So that's the importance of screening, and as I said, we can save lives and help other parents not to go through what we've gone through.
Right. And it's dylanquirkfoundation.com. That's dylanquirke foundation.com for anyone who wants more information, or if they want to put their backing into the foundation you've established in memory of your son.
Absolutely. Yeah. All the information here about screening, we'll help in any way we can. as I said, we've got a backlog of screening for the next number of months, but we'll get through that and move on. And if we can't do the screening ourselves, we'll help people. We work with a company called Advanced Medical Services in Cork. They do the screening for us, and they've been great to us. And I'd just like to thank the people, not just of Tipperary, but outside of Tipperary, for all the help they've given to us as a family, but also the funds that have been raised to help screening be a success.
Okay. And Dan, thanks for joining us today, and commiserations. I'm sure the pain hasn't dissipated over all the years, but you've established some legacy for Dylan.